Stepping up, Gilbert. Fires over the middle for the end zone. It's broken up, incomplete. Minka Fitzpatrick stepped in front of Schultz. And the game is over. And the Pittsburgh Steelers, for the first time in the history of their franchise, are 8-0 as they come back to knock off the Dallas Cowboys 24-19.
The Pittsburgh Steelers lived up to their name and did not bend as the Dallas Cowboys threatened their undefeated season. The ninth NFL Sunday brought winners who made huge statements, like the Saints and the Bills, and teams who can't seem to find a way to win, like the Los Angeles Chargers. Bill Barnwell has the goods on all of Sunday's action, plus how the rise in positive COVID tests on teams could affect the rest of this season. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, November 9th, and in honor of the late, great Alex Trebek, what is ESPN Daily? Bill Barnwell, we just watched the Saints blow out the Bucks 38-3, and after last week, I don't think I've ever been more grateful for a contest whose outcome was objectively and indisputably obvious by like 9 p.m. Bill Barnwell is the tireless host of the Bill Barnwell Show podcast. I think you're the Steve Kornacki of football. I hope you take that as a compliment.
Of course.
What did you see with your sleeves rolled up to your elbows?
Pablo, I was ready to declare the game at approximately the midway point of the first quarter. I mean, this was, I would say, the most dominant performance I've seen all year after you account for how good the opposing team is. Like, we make fun of the Jets a lot on this podcast.
We do.
The Saints made the Buccaneers look like the Jets, which is about as bad as it gets.
Yeah, I mean, the Bucs offense looked like, and this is the scientific football term, they looked like trash. And the Saints, they looked like the Saints of seasons past. So I want to start, actually, though, with the debut of Tom Brady's newest roommate, one-time star wideout Antonio Brown. Just real quick on him, what did we see from AB tonight?
Yeah, not much. I mean, Brown didn't really stand out. I mean, in his debut, he played about 78% of the snaps on offense. He was on the field pretty much all the time. Caught 3 of 5 targets for 31 yards.
In motion, Brown, Brady's pass, caught ball, Antonio Brown's got his first catch as a Buccaneer.
Honestly, the most conspicuous thing he did all game was he broke off a route that Tom Brady was expecting him to continue downfield. That led to one of Brady's 3 interceptions on the day. So not exactly the start I think Antonio Brown and his, I guess, landlord. I'm not sure what the rent paying situation is, but I think one of the worst games of Tom Brady's career, and Antonio Brown did not help matters.
Brady thinks the Saints are bringing pressure. They bring it from the other side. He's under pressure, rolling out to his right. He's going to throw a ball up in the air, and that ball's going to be picked off at the 30-yard line. Malcolm Jenkins gets in on the fun, and the Saints pick off Tom Brady for the third time tonight.
Yeah, Brady has had issues also with his receivers throughout this year, but Tampa's defense, Bill, I mean, by DVOA, this was the best defense in the entire league, and they end up looking shockingly vulnerable against New Orleans. So how did Drew Brees and the Saints dismantle that defense?
Yeah, so if you think about the Packers game for the Buccaneers defense, I mean, that was a quarterback who was on fire, and the Buccaneers were able to create pressure by sort of creating some confusion for Aaron Rodgers, and then their pass rush was getting home frequently enough that Aaron Rodgers wasn't able to kind of adjust. None of that happened with the Saints on Sunday night. I mean, the Buccaneers just didn't bother Drew Brees. There was one play where Shaq Barrett did strip sack Brees, and that was, you know, a brief moment of light for the Buccaneers, but otherwise Brees wasn't sacked. He really didn't even get bothered all that frequently. He was 26 of 32, and the Buccaneers do have some great cornerbacks and great players in coverage, Carlton Davis, Antoine Winfield. The Saints mostly avoided them and just threw to the guys who were either wide open or against the defenders like Jamel Dean, who aren't quite as good. This was a game where Michael Thomas, New Orleans' star receiver, came back after missing the past 2 months with ankle and hamstring issues. But in this game, 12 different Saints caught passes. And the only reason it wasn't 13 was because just weren't many eligible receivers left on the roster. I mean, guys who I didn't even realize were on the Saints were catching passes during this game.
Yeah, I met a lot of people on this team for the first time tonight. And I also know, Bill, that your column this week, I believe, is going to be your midseason awards, sure, your long-awaited midseason awards. And I don't want to, you know, give anything away here. You got to go read Bill on ESPN.com. But where did Sunday's performance by Tom Brady, how did that affect his MVP stock in your eyes?
I mean, I think he would have needed a really impressive game-winning performance to make it into the MVP picture. And as you might suspect, throwing three interceptions, posting one of the worst passer ratings of his entire career, that was not it. It's becoming pretty clear that Brady's performance is pretty dependent upon whether the offensive line can sort of take care of the pass rush and give Brady time to throw. And on Sunday, Brady looked a lot more like the guy who threw a pick six in week one against these very Saints and forgot how to count to four against the Bears. The Saints were able to really give Brady a hard time. Trey Hendrickson, their reserve defensive end, honestly made himself millions of dollars as a free agent to be with a two-sack performance on national television. Brady just didn't really have those opportunities to get set in the pocket, work through his progressions, and feel comfortable. I mean, he's been every bit as good as the Buccaneers could have hoped for most of this season. But really, honestly, based on how he's played against the Saints in these two crucial games, he's not on the same level as someone like a Russell Wilson or Patrick Mahomes right now.
He wasn't even really on the level of Garrett Gilbert today, Bill Barnwell. I mean, to move on to that game, which also defied expectations, I mean, the Steelers visited the Cowboys, who were quarterbacked by Garrett Gilbert a week after being quarterbacked by the immortal Ben DiNucci. And Pittsburgh, this time, they narrowly won 24-19, but they did see their life flash before their eyes a couple times. Ben Roethlisberger left just before halftime with an injury.
And a 13-6 lead for the Cowboys over the Steelers, and Roethlisberger hobbling up the tunnel with, it appears, some of the medical staff from the Steelers and pointing at that knee.
And then there were some costly turnovers down the stretch, but in the end, the Steelers do improve to 8-0 for apparently the first time in franchise history, and so they sit atop the AFC. But the question to me still remains, like, how good is a team that can only barely beat a Garrett Gilbert-led Cowboys team?
I don't know. I mean, I think the Steelers are good, but honestly, they were lucky to win this game. They were outplayed for most of the contest. They managed to come up with takeaways in the red zone and got Cowboys penalties at exactly the moments when they needed help to try and extend the game. Chris Boswell, their kicker, hit a 59-yard field goal. I mean, Pablo, the Steelers aren't as good as their record. I think that's fair to say. They're 8-0 by their Pythagorean expectation, their point differential. We would more typically associate that with something closer to a 6-2 football team. But at the same time, those wins are already in the bank. You can't take them away. They're healthy, relatively healthy at least. They're dominant on defense. And they do have a pretty easy schedule. And three of their next four games are against the Bengals, the Jaguars, and Washington, who are a combined 5-18-1. So honestly, if they can beat the Ravens on Thanksgiving and complete the season sweep, it wouldn't be shocking to see the Steelers at 12-0 when they travel to face the Bills on Sunday night in week 14.
Well, just two games behind those Buffalo Bills after today are the Miami Dolphins. And they won their second straight game with Tua Tagovailoa as their starter. And Field Yates said this: the Dolphins started 2019 0-7 with a historically poor point differential and were the laughingstock of the NFL. They're 10-7 since, with a promising rookie quarterback, a wildly improved defense, and tons of future draft capital. And Brian Flores is a damn good coach. So that's our colleague Field Yates praising these Dolphins. After everything you've seen over that same time span, Bill, are the Dolphins turning the corner for real at this point?
Well, Pablo, I know tanking is a topic near and dear to your heart.
It is. It really
is. And we've seen two teams really go out of their way to tank over the last 5 years in the NFL. The Browns are one of those two teams. The Browns won one game over two seasons, and they did get guys like Baker Mayfield and Myles Garrett in their building. They've also turned over the key roles in their organization at head coach, general manager, twice since they hit bottom. So their tank is really a work in progress at best. Mm. What the Dolphins have done, on the other hand, with their tanking project, looks to be a lot more promising. I mean, Field laid out just how bad they were at a point last year, but Miami was impressive in the second half of 2019. And then after an inconsistent start to this season, they've won four straight, including three victories against the NFC West, which we all think is maybe the best division in all of football. I don't think we can say anything significant or meaningful yet about Tua Tagovailoa, but he looked really impressive for large portions of his second career start against the Cardinals defense, Pablo, that really managed to slow down Russell Wilson in the second half and overtime in that victory a couple weeks ago. On Sunday, the Dolphins not only have their own first and second round picks in the 2021 draft, but they also have the first and second round picks handed to them by the now deposed Bill O'Brien in the Tunsil trade. Those could be top five selections to go on with their own picks. So I'm not sure tanking is a great move for an NFL organization, but I think it's hard to argue with how the results have turned out for the Dolphins so far.
So as for some results that people can argue with, Bill, can you tease some more of these midseason award categories that you're going to be writing about as you remain sleepless into this night?
Okay, so I mean, we're looking at the core awards here. Comeback Player of the Year, Offensive and Defensive Player of the Year, Offensive and Defensive Rookie of the Year, and MVP. And I don't want to spoil it too much, but MVP comes down to three quarterbacks. And honestly, if I want to maybe tease it with a little bit of excitement, I would say that the guy who was my MVP pick heading into week nine might not be the guy who is my MVP pick coming out of week nine based on how he played. And I'll say this much as well. We will not be holding the award ceremony in front of a landscaping store.
Up next, I'm going to bring Bill back right next to Fantasy Island. And we're going to talk about the Chargers, the Bills, and yes, once again on ESPN Daily, the New York Football Jets.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely. Drink wisely.
So, Bill, I want to talk to you about the LA Chargers here because they lost to the Vegas Raiders on this last second Justin Herbert touchdown pass. That was not a touchdown pass at all. It was incomplete.
This is the game. Snap. They rush forward. Goes to Parham. Jump ball. Caught. Waiting for the signal. Signal is touchdown! If there is something on the backside of the end zone, it might give you an idea whether or not that ball moved as he went, and it does. It is going to be incomplete. Again, how many touchdowns can I call that will get taken off the board?
Chargers have now lost a string of utter heartbreakers this season, and maybe that's the generous way of looking at it because they lose to the Broncos last week, to the Saints before that, to the Chiefs in overtime, now to the Raiders. But the generosity comes from this notion that actually the Chargers should be better than this, and they're not like the team that actually is the chokingest NFL team that ever choked, even more than the Falcons. So, Bill, how and why does this keep happening to this team?
Well, I mean, the Chargers, like you said, keep blowing games in heartbreaking fashion. But maybe the positive takeaway is that they didn't have a 2-touchdown lead before they blew the game. Maybe that's the tiniest little victory for the Chargers that they were losing for most of this game. And this was a different sort of loss. Let me set the scene here. The Chargers get the ball back. They're trailing by 5 with 4 minutes and 37 seconds to go. At which point they took their precious time driving the ball down the field. They used nearly 2 full minutes to gain 17 yards and then gave the ball to third string running back Josh Kelly and fourth string running back Kalen Ballage 9 consecutive times. No Keenan Allen, no Hunter Henry, no Mike Williams. The Chargers then ran two consecutive goal line fades. The scourge of Mina Kimes's
yes.
NFL insight. They were both newly caught, but neither of them were successful. They came up short and lost the game. This is a terrible way to run your game-winning drive. The Chargers had timeouts, but they used them after relatively useless 3 or 4 yard completions over the middle of the field. They didn't use their best weapons to try and gain significant yards until the last possible moment. In the big picture, I mean, there is this time-honored tradition in football suggesting that teams need to learn how to win close games. It's never made any sense to me. You look through history, there's no evidence, or at the very most, very little evidence, that teams have any ability to win or lose close games year after year. And before you even say so, Pablo, it's fair to say the Chargers may be an exception to that rule. Last year, we all kind of seemed to pin this on Phillip Rivers, that he would make a mistake in the final few minutes of the game. This is now the second season in a row. Phillip Rivers is in Indianapolis. I think it's fair to pin this now on Anthony Lynn and this coaching staff. The formula changes from week to week, but the story seems to always involve unforced errors, mental mistakes, and infuriating game management. One week, it's settling for and missing a 50-yard field goal. This week, it was fumbling away a punt in the fourth quarter and applying some real Andy Reid 2004 energy to their two-minute drill. At some point, the coaching staff has to take responsibility and change what's happening, because the Chargers could be a playoff team right now, and instead their season is basically over.
I mean, speaking of terrifying roller coasters, Bill, Josh Allen just hosted Russell Wilson, and that was overflowing with chaotic playoff energy. And Josh Allen ended up scoring 4 touchdowns on 415 yards passing.
And in motion coming to the near side. High snap caught by Allen. Shoves it over the middle. It's caught in the end zone. Gabriel Davis, touchdown, Buffalo.
To take the Bills to 7-2 for the first time since 1993. And going into this one, there were concerns about Buffalo's defense over the last couple weeks, but it seemed like Seattle's defense, that was the big problem here. So what did you see from the Seahawks on Sunday?
Yeah, I don't think the Seahawks have a viable pass defense right now. And we saw the Bills exploit that to really an unprecedented extent on Sunday. So the Bills ran 31 plays in the first half on offense. They threw the ball 28 times out of 31. ESPN has play-by-play data going back through 2008. No team has ever been more pass happy in the first half of a game than the Bills were on Sunday. Those 5 drives produced 3 touchdowns, a field goal, and a miss from 61 yards out at the end of the half. And I know the box score will tell you the Seahawks sacked Josh Allen 7 times, but several of those sacks were plays where Josh Allen was holding onto the football or scrambling or trying to make a play. This was Seattle's best game of the year when it came to creating sacks and pass pressure, but even with that in the numbers, they're still well below average in terms of both sack rate and pressure rate. And when they don't get pressure, the Seahawks secondary are sitting ducks. They just haven't been able to hold up. They've been able to survive and win games by coming up with fourth down stops and creating takeaways, but they weren't able to force any turnovers against the Bills offense on Sunday. And in the big picture, Seattle might get better, but I'm not sure they're going to live up to the preseason expectations they had on defense, especially in the secondary. And that's mostly because of injuries. The Seahawks could hope to be healthier, I suppose, but the pass defense has been something that opposing offenses have exploited all season against the Seahawks. We just haven't seen a team relentlessly targeted the way the Bills did on Sunday. And I think it's going to give other teams a blueprint for what they might want to do to try and beat Russell Wilson and company.
Bill, as we get further into the season now, there's also this other enormous topic I want to ask you about, because we keep seeing this uptick in positive COVID tests around the NFL. We saw this last Thursday with the Packers and the Niners game being directly impacted by this. And now as we get through the back half of the season, I'm curious, what kind of an impact is this rise in cases going to have on rosters? And what kind of impact might it even have on the playoff picture?
It could have a dramatic impact on the playoff picture. I mean, in the past, we've talked on the show about how the impact of COVID, you know, changed the way teams acted around the trade deadline and discouraged them from pursuing deals. Teams probably would have made more trades if it were not for COVID. And I think actually, we're seeing how the league is changing their comfort level with the virus and what it would take to postpone a game. And go back to the Chiefs-Patriots game earlier this year, where two players tested positive, one on each side, Patriots quarterback Cam Newton.
Cam Newton has tested positive for COVID. So Cam Newton will not be making that trip. He is out of Sunday's game. And now the question is, are there any other members of the organization who have been in close contact with him who also have tested positive?
And Chiefs practice squad passer Jordan Ta'amu. They both test positive. The game is delayed. On Thursday, we saw the Packers without two players, including starting running back Jamal Williams. And the 49ers lost four players, including star left tackle Trent Williams and starting wide receiver Kendrick Bourne, who was the one who tested positive. So six players were missing in that game. And the league went ahead with that game without postponing it or delaying it. Yesterday, the Dolphins played against the Cardinals without five of their coaches who were unavailable because of COVID testing. The big concern here, when it comes to the end of the season, is that the league's going to get too aggressive and end up with teams playing against totally compromised opponents in sort of the same way we saw with the Niners on Thursday night. As teams play into December, what happens if we get a situation like, say, the Seahawks playing the Rams in Week 16 in a game that could impact the NFC West, playoff seeding, and even the MVP race for Russell Wilson? Let's say there's a positive test 3 days before that game, and the Rams suddenly lose four starters. Without any bye weeks left to change things, would the NFL be willing to open up an 18th week just for that one individual game? If that happened in Week 3, there would be no issue. Now, that's changed. And if there's a multi-week outbreak, like the one the Titans were dealing with earlier this year, the league could really compromise their regular season by trying to keep things normal. On top of all that, there's the reality of what's going to happen late in the season when non-competitive teams start dealing with positive tests. The Jets are barely a functional NFL team when everyone is healthy. So what happens if there's an outbreak in December? They have games against the Raiders, the Seahawks, the Rams, the Browns, all possible playoff teams. Is it better for the league to have the Jets play those games? Would forfeits even come into play? It's one thing to say everyone is going to have to deal with the unknown. But I think what might seem more unfair to teams is that the rules about what's going to cause a postponement, what's going to qualify for a meaningful COVID outbreak, that's clearly changing as the season goes on.
And that gets us into the existentialism of the New York Jets, because they are playing Monday night against the Patriots. The Patriots battling to bounce back from their loss to the Bills last week. The winless Jets still wandering through the NFL desert looking for anything resembling water. But it's also unclear, like, are they trying at this point to seriously win games? Is that still their foremost goal? So, Bill, in this Monday night game, what are you going to be watching for?
Okay, so the Jets are fighting a lot of irrelevant battles this season. But the one I am paying the closest attention to is watching what offensive genius Adam Gase is doing at the bottom of the league's offensive ranking. So this year, teams are scoring nearly 2 full points per game more than any other season in league history. And on a drive-by-drive basis, NFL offenses are averaging 2.26 points per possession. And the top 31 teams in the league are in a range between the Giants, who are 31st at 1.62 points per game, and the Seahawks and Packers, who are top of the league at 3.01 points per drive. The Jets are averaging exactly 1.000 points per possession.
A flat one.
An even one. They're not even in the same ballpark as the rest of the NFL. Only two teams, Pablo, have been worse over the first half of the season over the last 5 years. One is the 2018 Bills, who started Josh Allen, Derek Anderson, and yes, the Peterman himself, Nathan Peterman, over that stretch.
Oh, I love a good Peterman cameo. Was not expecting that, but anytime we get it, we've got two of these so far with you, Bill.
The other team in this list is not a Peterman-related team, but the next closest thing. It's the 2019 Jets, who were averaging 0.91 points per possession last year. So, to be fair, Adam Gase can credibly sit here and say, hey, I put the offense into hyperdrive. We've improved on offense versus the first half of 2019. With Sam Darnold out, Joe Flacco expected to start, I think there's a chance the 2020 Jets could actually go below 1 point per possession in offense on Monday night.
Bill Barnwell, the ESPN Daily leader in points per possession. Thank you for making us smarter once again this week.
It hurts me a little bit to know that I would be replaced by Nathan Peterman if he became available for this Monday slot in about 2 seconds.
I have a soft spot for that guy.
That's fair. That's fair.
All right, coming up, how the biggest story in America and the world is a sports story, too.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. The truest taunt on the internet is that line about how someone is living rent-free inside your head. Because in 2020, if we're being totally honest, there is no bigger win than that. Everyone is competing for attention, for eyeballs, for the real estate of your brain. And by that standard, Donald Trump has been far more than the biggest winner in global news, as the president of the United States often is. What's been so crazily different is that he's also been the single most influential person across our culture, like no other president ever has. Over these last 4 years in sports, especially, there is no close second place. We've lived a case study in what happens when an American president uses his bully pulpit to fire off an endless stream of takes. Sometimes they were as petty as this moment just last week when Trump erroneously trashed NBA Finals TV ratings at a campaign stop in Pennsylvania.
How about basketball? How about LeBron? I felt badly for LeBron. I felt very badly. Down 71%. And that's for their champion. I didn't watch one shot. I get bored. Back, forth. You know why? When they don't respect our country, when they don't respect our flag, nobody wants to watch. Nobody.
And other times, his takes were as gravely disturbing as the speech he gave in Alabama in September 2017 about athletes kneeling during the national anthem.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
Joe Biden was hired as the 46th president of the United States on Saturday. He will be the next person whose every word, every mood, every grievance will feel historical and important. And for that reason, the relationship between sports and politics is about to shift in an extremely conspicuous way. No, Biden's probably not going to feud with the entire National Basketball Association. He's probably not going to command the NFL, a private enterprise, to punish certain employees for insufficient demonstrations of patriotism. Biden's probably not going to turn pretty much every sport, from college football to women's soccer to NASCAR, into a battleground in a hotly contested culture war. Now, to be clear, sports has always been and will always be inherently political. But sports doesn't have to be like these last 4 years, with Trump picking fights and daring athletes to choose silence or their dignity. It doesn't have to be so exhausting, with sports fans from both political parties longing for anything resembling relative normalcy. And it doesn't have to be so easy for all of us to let the same person live rent-free inside our heads. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.